You and I are hard to please. Young, we want desperately to jump into grown-up shoes. Grown up, we read Mark Twain, and we long for the afternoon sunshine and the endless baseball of the schoolyard. The farther behind us our childhood is, the more glamorous and magical it seems to have been. The young chafe under its restraints. 70-year-old George Bernard Shaw remarks, "The only trouble with youth is that it's wasted on the young." And a graybeard Solomon in the biblical book of Ecclesiastes advises the young not to puff and to pant, to put behind them their childhood, to enjoy the golden years. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth. Follow the will of thy heart and the sight of thine eyes. Now there's a vast literature which makes of youth a sweet thing of sunlit days, endless happiness. Pollyanna, Little Women, Little Lord Fauntleroy. Where did you go? Out. What did you do? Nothing. And we were all taught as children that grown-up nursery rhyme. What are little boys made of? Snips and snails and puppy dog tails. That's what little boys are made of. And what are little girls made of? Sugar and spice and everything nice. That's what little girls are made of. But are they? Were we? Is youth that sweet innocence, that gay abandon, that endless game? Ever since Dr. Freud has scalpeled youth, revealed to us its darkness and its depth, we've had to put aside these simplicities. Freud revealed to us the terrors of the night dream, the bitter sibling and love rivalry, the anguished loneliness of not knowing who we actually are, and a generation of readers and critics raised and nurtured on this psychology have dismissed the glamorization of youth. It's naive. It's romantic. I do not challenge this dismissal. I do challenge the fact that often the two classics of Mark Twain, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, are included in this sophisticated dismissal. I do not believe that either of these books was written for children by freighted, worried, middle-aged authors to convince the child of what he should instinctively, natively know, that he's enjoying himself. Actually, both books were written for adults. It was only in the last instance that the editor in both cases was able to persuade Mark Twain to expurgate certain swear words and expletives from the text so that both of them might make an extra dollar from the children's trade. Now, whatever else he may have been, Mark Twain was not a naive man. What possible interest could he have imagined that world-weary, cynical adults, you and I, might have in the simple adventures of a simple small-town boy along the banks of the Mississippi? who never have bought the book, if that was all that it was or purported to be. But I would suggest to you this morning that both of these volumes are quite deliberately contrived. They do not purport to be the case history of a glorified childhood. Rather, they are of the literature of nostalgia, symbolic. Mark Twain highlighted and brought together our memories of what youth was. He didn't set out to explain, to draw clearly, realistically, what youth actually is, but he gave flesh and body to adult memories of childhood. He emphasized the things which we remember. He omitted the things which we repress and keep out of our conscience. And he did so quite deliberately, because he wanted us to ask one question. What became of the barefoot boy when he put on shoes? What became of the honesty of friendship, the clear eye, the broad expectation, the thirst for life, the passion for justice and human relations, when the child became man? How did the Missouri river bottom boy become the Missouri sharper? Both these books were written in the 1880s. They were written during that period which is called by our historians the nadir of our national disgrace. The social fabric of America was weak. Our people were self-indulgent and greedy and grasping. This was the era of the robber baron, of the land grafts, of widespread bribery in government, of the exploitation of labor, of unconscionable excess in all areas of finance and of business. And these books were a protest. How could the child of the 1830s have become the adult, the cynical adult of the 1880s? Instead of preaching, damning, Mark Twain reminded, and he asked the money-greedy reader if this wasn't the youth that he remembered himself to be, and if so, ought he not to make some changes in the dimensions and the horizons of his life? In brief, Dr. Freud and those who follow him analyze the darkness of childhood in order to explain to us how certain children become tied up within themselves, in order to give us understanding so that we may smooth out, unravel the knots, and permit them to move ahead and rebuild the fabric of their lives. Mark Twain highlighted the nostalgia of childhood so that we might ask ourselves how the tied-up adult, ourselves, could unravel the passions of his life and become somehow again the free, open-minded, open-handed, just boy that he remembered himself to be. It takes a preacher to know a preacher, to see the judgment behind the tolerance and the tolerance behind the judgment, the search for the apposite story, the eye which constantly marks the difference between performance and possibility, between act, promise. And though Twain would have roared out had he heard me label him a preacher, that is what he was throughout his life, ever and always. Mark Twain prided himself on being an outspoken man and violating the conformities of life. He was not above the expletive, the short, direct, statement. He was not enough above poking fun at the long-windedness of preachers, the pomposities of certain kinds of church piety. Again and again, he returned to the theology of his Presbyterian background and found much in it to criticize. The concept of infant damnation, psychology of original sin, the patronizing tolerance of the whole missionary complex. Beyond this, though Twain could in print rail against the preacher and describe benefit of clergy as half rate on the railroads, though he once observed that if Christ were to return on earth, the one thing that he would not be would be a Christian, he was, above all else, preacher, moralist, biblicist. Mark Twain had the misfortune of being born with a Yiddish cup, a set of instinctive Jewish attitudes in a straight-laced, fundamentalist, border Christian community. He had no tolerance of the pie in the sky, the otherworldly emphasis of religion in his day. It was the here and the now, the social, the just, the building of the good society which concerned him. He had no patience with a psychology which talked of man's being hobbled by some primordial sin. Man was a creature of God, created in God's image, potentially the builder of fine societies. What troubled Twain was not man's inadequacy, but his ineptness. Not man's psychology, but his lack of performance and of principle. Every preacher has a text. Twain wrote his own. He was too proud to take one from our Bible. His text was simple. Man is the only creature that blushes or needs to. And he spent his life, his books, his lectures, and his reporting, analyzing, elaborating on this simple truth. He asked himself always, what is it that ought to bring the blush of shame to man's cheeks? And he set out deliberately to make this clear. Now, his generation was never quite sure that Twain was a preacher. He didn't wear the black suit. He was anything but genteel in genteel society. He could not be counted on to say the appropriate word at the appropriate occasion. His mind tended to satire and bitter humor. And yet when he was honest with himself, late in his life, he was willing to admit that he was essentially moralist. I give you these three sentences taken from his biography. I have always preached, if humor came of its own accord and uninvited, I have allowed it a place in my sermon. But I was not writing the sermon for the sake of the humor. I should have written the sermon just the same, whether any humor applied for admission or not. He wrote the story of a prince and a pauper, lookalikes, who exchanged robe and roll. It's a delightful story. Captures your mind and carries you along, but he wrote it for a single purpose, to show how the laws of the world would quickly be changed if for even an instant, an hour, the rulers of the world had to live under the laws that they imposed upon man. He penned a delightful story, which he entitled The Man Who Corrupted Hadleyburg. It's a story of a small, isolated western town, very proud of itself, convinced that it was upright, full of character and probity, beyond reproach. And somehow this town, Hadleyburg, earned the anger of a visiting traveling man. And this traveling man set out to show the good citizens of Hadleyburg that they were not quite the saints they believed themselves to be. He brought into town a sack of gold. And he said that inside the sack there were a set of instructions which the man who had performed for the traveler a certain good deed would know and would be able to answer. And of course, every citizen of the town perjured himself, wanting the bank account, the gold. It's a delightful story. Its purpose? To show Americans, in their individual communities and nationally, the isolated, insulated, self-righteous American community of the 19th century, that it was no better than those cruel commercial people across the water. America was secure. America had not known the temptations of Europe, but America ought to think twice before it criticizes and castigates. People are people. Wherever they may be. We know of Twain's remarkable personal history, as printer, printer's assistant, as prospector for silver in the fields of California, as riverboat captain, as travelogue, author and lecturer, as author, writer, as businessman and as inventor, humorist, satirist of a society. I would like briefly this morning to underscore my point, my label of Mark Twain, the preacher. His first two lines, which I should like to quote for you, I take particular delight in. They evidence the quality of the man and the quality of our people, who somehow can never believe a human being can be absolutely tolerant. A few years ago, Mark Twain wrote, a Jew observed to me that there was no uncourteous reference to his people in my book and asked how it happened. It happened because the disposition was lacking. The Gospel of Peace, he wrote on another occasion, has always made a great deal of noise, always rejoicing in its progress, yet always neglecting to furnish statistics. There are no peaceful nations now. All Christendom is a soldier camp. The poor have been taxed in some nations to the starvation point to support the giant armies which Christian governments have built up, each to protect itself from the rest of the Christian Brotherhood, and incidentally, to snatch a scrap of real estate left exposed by a weaker owner. Here's a lesson that those of us who watch and comment on our Latin American relations could well take to heart. All gentle cant and philosophies to the contrary notwithstanding, no people in the world ever did achieve their freedom by goody-goody truths and moral suasion. It being the inevitable law that all revolution that will succeed must begin in blood, whatever may answer afterward. If history has anything to teach, it teaches that. And finally, a vignette set in a church not so long ago. It was a time of great and exulting excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. Sunday morning came. Next day the battalions would leave for the front. Church was filled. Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it for passionate pleading, moving, beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever merciful and benign Father of us all would watch over our noble young youth and aid and comfort and encourage them in their patriotic work, bless them, shield them in the day of battle. An aged stranger entered and moved with slow and noiseless step up the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister. With all eyes following him, wondering, he made his silent way without pausing. He ascended to the preacher's side and stood there, waiting. Then finally, in a deep voice, he said, "I come from the throne. I bear a message from Almighty God. God has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and he will grant it if such shall be your desire after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import. For it is like unto many of the prayers of men, in that it asks for more than that he who utters it is aware of. You have heard your servant's prayer, the uttered part of it. I am commissioned of God to put into words the other part of it, the part which the pastor and also you in your hearts fervently prayed silently. Listen. O Lord our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them. With them in spirit we also go forth unto the sweet peace of our, from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out ruthless with their little children to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolate land in rags and hunger and thirst, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave denied them. For our sakes who adore thee, O Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protect their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, the love of him who is the source of love, the love of him who is ever faithful, a refuge and friend of all that are sore beset and seek with his aid, humble, contrite, his protection. This we speak in his name. Amen. You have prayed it. If you still desire it, speak. This is a soul. Soul of a man who had no patience with cant, with hypocrisy, with the short-sighted wants of selfish men, who saw beyond the passions of the moment the principle, justice and peace and brotherhood. This is the soul of a preacher. Mark Twain was a man. There is no man on earth so righteous that he sinneth not. Being mortal, he sinned. He had his failings, his extravagances. He was not always right. But he was a passionate man. He was a man of principle. And however unorthodox his theology may have been, however he may have ruffled the feathers of the respectable of the community, however he may have in his life sometimes belied the truth of his own charges, his words must be listened to for their own intrinsic merit. We have need of such lay preachers in every generation. We have need of those who are willing to look at the church, the synagogue, as it is, a human institution, and being human, frail, capable of awkward activity, capable of irrelevance, capable of being wrong. Now, the church of his day was not quite as misguided, misdirected, as Twain made it out to be. It was the cement of the social fabric. It was the home of decency and dignity. It did maintain and teach the ancient moral truths of our Bible. But like the church of any generation, it sought respectability as much as righteousness. The pulpit voiced the prejudice of the congregation as much as the principle of the sacred text. We have need of those who are friendly yet critical, who will remind us always to walk the narrow way, to abide the truths that we proclaim, to wrestle with our conscience as we wrestle for the conscience of man. There was a certain presence, a charisma to Mark Twain. He was a big man, powerfully built. His pictures show a mane of flowing hair, a powerful mustache across his face. He was possessed of a deep voice. He was an excellent lecturer. Indeed, he made his money in that way. He was a man whose words had to be accounted for. His pen had to be read. His charges had to be answered. We need such citizens in every generation. Men who will prick and prod the social conscience. Men who will continue the work of the preacher in the marketplace and in the newspapers and in the public forums of the day. Men who will use a variety of techniques to drive home the moralist's text. In the Talmud we read that a minister, lo yidaber kategoria Yisrael, shall never be a prosecuting attorney against the congregation. It is good, good preaching advice. Twain went one step further. He recognized that often in humor, when men can learn to laugh at their own foibles, when they can see an exaggerated picture of their own postures and pretense, they will come to amendment, to a changing of the way. Humor, he once said, sets the thinking machinery in motion. And it is true. If a man charges us with sin, we deny it. If he holds up a mirror to us and without comment allows us to see ourselves, we see ourselves. And if he does it with good humor and in a kindly vein and without holding himself above, he will be effective. Mark Twain was a good preacher. His message was one of the natural possibility of men. At boyhood, with all of its expectancy, with all of its urgency, with all of its honesty, can become manhood. If only the boy, man, is consistent, disciplined, and abides the truth and integrity of his own principles. Mark Twain sets a high standard for all of us. He merits, even now, our rereading. Although none of us had the boyhood of a Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn, that we are the creatures of urban societies and not of the frontier village. There is yet something of Tom in each of us, something of the failing of Tom become man in each of us. Mark Twain can be for us, as he was for his generation, an effective, meaningful preacher. Amen.